Legalization of marijuana or women's rights, the people's issues are covered on these airways. So stay tuned for the best and leading edge progressive ideas and analysis. And remember to support independent media financially.
It's 7:02, and you're listening to non-corporate, listener-funded, community-controlled WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM, streaming globally at WBAI.org. I'm Johanna Fernandez, your host of It's a Good Day. And now we would like to play a brief interview I conducted with Just, who's an incarcerated comrade and friend of It's a Good Day. Just will provide an update on how this COVID-19 pandemic is affecting him in the federal prison. Let's take a listen.
Hi there. So talk to me. How are you?
I'm good. We've been locked down for about 10 days now. They have us paired two to a cell on lockdown. We're in the cell 24 hours a day, except for 3 days a week where they'll let us out for an hour.
Each of those days they'll let you out for an hour. Wow. Is there enough social distancing with two people to a cell?
Social distancing is impossible. I was actually in a cell alone. Along with a few people who were in a cell alone, and they actually forced me to get a roommate, and I had initially refused, so they forced me to move to another cell to live with somebody, you know, because I had the same concerns that, like, how can you socially distance when you have a cell? So basically they make it so that if, God forbid, people do get sick here, you know, it's almost guaranteed that, you know, your cell, you get sick, you're going to get it.
Right. So you were moved to another cell with another cellmate.
Yes.
So that doesn't make any sense.
Well,
I mean, you were in a cell alone and they were going to put someone in there. And you refused or you complained, and so they were like, okay, well, we'll just put you in another cell with someone else, the same situation.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess it's a petty punishment.
Yeah. And they did that with a few people because I wasn't the only one who initially refused to take a cell.
And so what's the atmosphere in the prison?
There's a lot of mutual aid, you know. A lot of people are helping out each other. Believe it or not, the officers are a little bit more civil than usual. Like, this is a lockdown, but it doesn't have the air of collective punishment like most lockdowns have, you know.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So people are coming around, like the orderlies in the unit, the inmate orderlies in the unit are going around, you know, giving when they're outside the cell, you know, giving ice to everybody, you know, hot water and stuff like that. So there's definitely an air of mutual aid amongst each other, you know.
And how do you understand or explain the different attitude of the guards?
Well, I think that they understand that they have to be here too, you know. So if an infection occurs, even though that they go home at the end of the day, you know, they have to live with us as well, you know. So they are just as culpable to getting sick as everybody else, you know. And, like, even in Oakdale, where there was the first outbreak, Oakdale, Louisiana, you know, a lot of the officers were getting sick, you know. So we're sort of in a situation where, for once, we have actually had similar grievances.
Right. It's a rare moment in history.
Yeah. And interestingly, you know, like I was telling a comrade, you know, this is like the entire BOP is shut down, you know, and it's almost unprecedented that something like this has happened. You know, it's like the functional equivalent of a strike nationwide, everywhere, in every prison. You know, no Unicor is shut down. Everything is shut down. You know, it's. I mean, without that stimulus money that the BOP recently got, you know, the system might have reached a crisis point. You know.
How do you think the stimulus is affecting the prisons?
Well, they recently gave us. They actually, with the stimulus money, they did recently give us free phone minutes. So I'm on this phone call for free.
Okay.
So that's good. I assume that the rest of it would go to pay for, you know, the personal protective equipment for the officers and stuff like that. They did give us masks. They did give us everybody masks. You know, I heard a rumor that they were making it at Unicor, that they let, like, a certain amount of people go to Unicor and make masks.
And what is Unicor?
Unicor is the prison factory, and they produce, over here they produce military uniforms. And, you know, in multiple prisons all throughout the BOP, they have factories where they are under contract with private companies or with government agencies. Actually, the majority of the factories in the federal prison system actually make things for federal agencies.
This call is from a federal prison.
Federal agencies at very, very cheap wages, you know.
And have you worked for Unicor? You probably can't.
Well, I mean, I guess I can apply, but I never wanted to.
Right. What are the wages?
The wages are about, over here in Georgia, the wages are about $100 a month.
And how many hours do workers?
From work. 7:30 to 3:30.
Oh, wow. Okay, so it's a full day.
Yeah, so, I mean, for a prisoner who doesn't have a lot of money coming in, it's very, you know, attractive to it, you know, because understandably, a lot of people go to work there, you know, when they don't have any other money coming in, you know.
And what's the perception among workers of Unicor?
A lot of people actually like it because, like I said, you know, people do perceive it as a form of slavery, as a form of cheap labor, but at the same time, you know, it's, like I said, it's very attractive, you know, because especially for people who don't have any means of income, you know, so they utilize it, you know, a lot of people see it as like a necessary evil, you know.
And it's also a way to pass the time, I can imagine.
And it's a way to pass the time. Many people work there to pass the time as well.
Yeah, it cuts through the monotony of imprisonment.
Yeah.
And so how are you feeling? How are your spirits?
You know, I've been in ad sec before. I've been in administrative segregation before, 24 hours in a cell, you know, and it's not something that I'm unfamiliar with. And, like, as for me, like, this is going to sound weird, but I sort of like it.
Mm-hmm.
If it wasn't for the fact that there was a pandemic going on and I was, there's a threat of getting sick and I got worried about family, you know, it's something that I'm used to, that my mind has been used to, you know, very acclimated towards in the past, you know. Especially I get along with my celly, so that's good.
So why do you like it? Why do you kind of like it?
Maybe, I don't know. Maybe it's a testament to, you know, what, you know, solitary has done to my mind. Or, it, you know, where you just get used to it. Or maybe it's just that, you know, I tend to do my time alone, you know, I tend to read books and write and stuff like that, you know, so that it gives me more time to do that.
And I imagine that it's a relief from the chaos of prison life.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely it is.
So it's kind of a double-edged sword. I mean, you're isolated, but at the same time, I mean, isolation is never a good thing. But at the same time, it's a removal from the capricious rules of prison life and the violence that can emerge.
Right. Right. You know, I have to worry about a lot of the drama that comes with, like you said, you know, prison life. Yeah.
And can you, do you have a television in your cell? How do you connect to what's going on in the world?
No, we don't have televisions in the BOP, in the cell. But we listen to the radio. We listen to NPR.
Okay.
That's usually our source of news.
And is that by choice? Do you have the option of turning the dial?
Yeah. We have, they sell radios on commissary.
Like, okay.
You know,
so that's just the preferred. Radios. That's the preferred station.
It's a preferred station for many people, including myself.
So what
here in rural Georgia, like, you get NPR, you get like the gospel stations, and you get a couple hip hop stations. That's really it.
And I see. And so there's very limited.
Yeah.
There are limited pickings. So what do you make about the current moment in American history?
I think that, like I said, this is something that's unprecedented, but it's also something that is exposing a lot about society here. I mean, I could speak about prison. You know, about how it exposes the overpopulation here. Well, not just here in this prison, but everywhere in all across the system. And it also exposes the iniquities in society in general, you know, and how workers are getting laid off, how black and brown people are disproportionately affected by this virus due to the conditions that they live in, you know, and it exposes a lot about the society that we already live in, the crises that, you know, have already, you know, been part of this society, you know.
Yeah.
That's how I look at it.
It just intensifies everything that has already existed, but it makes the invisible visible to everybody.
Yeah. Absolutely. And they're going to, he's actually locking us down right now.
Meaning that you have to get off the phone?
Yeah, I have to get off the phone, unfortunately.
This call is from a federal prison.
Okay, Dust. Well, listen, be safe, and we'll talk soon.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
I'll talk to you as soon as I can, okay?
Definitely. Thank you. You too. Be safe.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
In 1959, Cuba had abundant, overlapping medical systems in the cities that were not working. A weak state-run healthcare system for the poor, whose services were unknown to many. A severe doctor shortage because many fled after the revolution, and virtually no rural medicine, vaccination program, or pediatric care. But the Cuban Revolution changed this. The Cuban Revolution's principal task was to create egalitarian access to comprehensive clinical, environmental, and community health, to bring cohesion to a fractured system and reconceptualize medical care for all. The revolution created the Ministry of Public Health. The ministry's focused interventions included hospital construction, a mass increase in doctor training, and later medical research. How? Through active recruitment of peasants and the poor. It also included the mass expansion of medical care to rural areas and an emphasis on health literacy through widespread public education campaigns. Finally, the system prioritized preventative care through the proliferation of its integrated polyclinic. What was a polyclinic? A local clinic that offered comprehensive, curative, and preventive medical services either on site at a clinic or through house calls. It worked with whole families and documented their medical histories and involved patients in the coordination of local health campaigns. Each patient was assigned to a comprehensive team of providers that included a primary care doctor, a nurse, an OBGYN specialist, a dentist, and a social worker. The clinics ensured medical care for all by deploying their medical teams to schools, to communities, to workplaces, and the island's most remote rural areas. Today, we are proud to be joined by Dr. Melissa Barber, a Bronx native who was trained in medicine in Cuba at the Latin American School of Medicine, or ELAM, E-L-A-M. Dr. Barber is now using her training in comprehensive community care to organize her own community in the Bronx against the coronavirus pandemic. Dr. Barber, can you give me a sense of where you're from and why you decided to study medicine in Cuba?
So I was born and raised in the Bronx, the South Bronx specifically. I think that one of the reasons I decided and chose to study medicine in Cuba was, one, the fact that they have a notable reputation worldwide for just the medical training and what they do. I think the hands-on approach was something that very much appealed to me. And I also think that the approach of community medicine and the aspect of the health access or health care being a right to every citizen was something that very much called to me and something that I thought drew me to the Cuban system of learning much more than here in the United States.
Can you give us a sense of how you learned about the program and what's your background? I mean, I'm certain that our listening audience is just anxious to hear who you are, who your parents are, where were you raised, and how did you discover Cuba as a possibility for medical training?
I was raised in a single parent home. My mother's an African American woman, so I identify more with being an African American. However, having roots from many different ethnicities. I actually was always, I can't even remember when I didn't want to be a medical doctor. So I think those roots actually were drawn, like ingrained into me from the time I was actually about 10 years old. And I think the first inkling that I got of wanting to be a doctor was first reading a book that taught me where babies came from, and I was always interested in women's health, maternal infant health. And so I think that's, you know, when I first read that book and my mom took me to the library to get that, I was like, that's what I want to do, that's what I want to be. And and just the community that I was raised in, I had a lot of I like to say that I'm homegrown, right? And that in the community that I was nurtured in the South Bronx, I had neighbors, I had friends, family who were just advocates. And, you know, from very early on, one of my neighbors, Nitsa Vera, she was an advocate for the community. She did needle exchange. She did advocacy services for a domestic violence clients. She just did a whole bunch of stuff. And I remember from very early on, she would take us to places like needle exchange, and she would take us to places that would do advocacy work for the community. So at a very early age, I and her kids were actually exposed to that, and that aspect of just community medicine, social medicine, and community well-being, and being an advocate for the people in your community. So I think a lot of that, I grew up having that background, just being a part of who I am and always identifying with that. I took that throughout school with me, throughout my undergraduate years. And in my undergraduate year, I was out of school. I went to Ursinus College. I was able to travel doing exchanges. I lived in Spain for a really long time. I did Mexico. And in when I was in Mexico, in Cuernavaca, I found out about the medical school there in Guadalajara. And I was like, oh my goodness, you know, for the first time, I can actually speak Spanish and do medicine in Spanish. And so I really had this whole take on that I would do medicine in Spanish and learn medicine in Spanish and kind of be that doctor that would come and translate that back home into the United States. And a few years after that, while I was studying at Ursinus and applying for medical school, taking my MCATs, I still had this drive in me to study medicine internationally. I was told in by many of my professors and many of the people who were in charge of advising me that that was not a very smart idea for somebody who was young, Black, and very intelligent like I was to want to go to medical school overseas. And so I was very much not encouraged to do that. However, I love the fact that I listened to God and I listened to the path that He designed for my life, and I knew that somehow I would go overseas to study medicine. Within a few months of me graduating, one of my friends at the time called me and she's like, do you still want to do medical school? Do you still want to go overseas to do medicine? And she's like, you know, this program that we heard about, that program that we heard about so long ago, like they're actually implementing it. And she was like, there's a couple of catches. So she was like, you know, I'll tell you about the catches and you figure out if, you know, this is something that you want to do. And so the first catch was that it was in Cuba. And I was like, are you kidding? They have like the best medical school in the world and they're the best trained doctors. And she's like, the second, the program is 6 years instead of, 4. And I was like, well, you know, I've lived all over the place. So uprooting and going, elsewhere for 2 more years is not a big deal. And she said, well, the third catch is that the deadline is today. So here's all of the numbers and figure out what you're going to do with this. And so with that, I took those numbers and I just kept calling. And I said, somebody needs to contact me back because I know that this is the place that I need to be. And
wow. Can I just let my listening audience know that the name of that school that you're referring to, which is world famous, is... Yeah. the Latin American School of Medicine, yes, or ELAM, mm-hmm, as it's known by its Spanish initials. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you another question, because we have quite a number of folks from the Bronx who are listening, mm-hmm, in right now. Where, mm-hmm, did you grow up in the Bronx, and where did you go to school, say to elementary school, junior high school, and high school?
Oh, good. I grew up right across the street from Bronx Lebanon Hospital on 1546 Selwyn Avenue. Then we moved to Northwest Bronx, and then we moved back to the South Bronx. So that's where I spent my beginnings, 1546 Selwyn Avenue. I went to elementary school at St. Angelo Merici, which is on 163rd Street and Morris Avenue. So I spent a lot of my youth there. I went to public schools, and in my neighborhood, I can't even remember the number of that public school, but it was on... it was by the highway on 174th Street in the Bronx as well. And so, yeah, like, I'm a product of the South Bronx. I'm a product of the South Bronx.
Wow.
And, yeah, born and raised, and no matter where I go in the world, no matter where I go and live throughout New York City, I always come back home, because nothing feels quite like this.
Well, you and I both, girlfriend, because I grew up on the Grand Concourse, not far from Bronx, Lebanon, a block and a half away, at 1460 Grand Concourse, in fact, between 171st and 172nd. And I went to PS 64, mm-hmm, in that neighborhood, which was the elementary school. But then we moved to Mohegan Avenue in the South Bronx, mm-hmm, and I went to PS 52, and then junior high school 22, the best years of my life. I was in a marching, mm-hmm, band.
Yeah.
So I'm feeling you on this Bronx nationalism for sure.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And so now you're back in the Bronx, and
yeah,
and you've come, you know, full circle. You've come back home. Can you, mm-hmm, tell us a little bit about what you're doing with this profound experience you had in Cuba?
Okay, so first I need to plug in, because I know I get killed if I don't say this, but I actually, my 9 to 5 most times is actually working for the organization that facilitates the medical school scholarship for U.S. students to go to ELAM. So I actually, you know, every day of the week from Monday through Friday run that and oversee that program. And we, for the last 19 years, if Co-Pastors for Peace, has been facilitating that medical school scholarship program for U.S. students to go, especially Black and Brown students, to go to medical school in Cuba for free. So any of you who are out there listening to this, and you have a desire to want to do medicine, you have some pre-med classes under your belt, it is a viable option. It is very possible. Do not listen to the voices that tell you that you cannot do this and that it's not available to you, because it is very much available. So I want everybody who's listening to know that first and foremost. And then we can circle back now into where I'm at in the Bronx. So not only do I do that on a regular basis, but I am a part of a coalition. I was a co-founding member of a coalition called the South Bronx Unite. And we are a coalition of volunteer members of the community, organizations that are throughout the community, and some of our allies. And we have come together on a platform to just really advocate for the South Bronx, advocate for environmental justice for the South Bronx, advocate for the well-being of the South Bronx. We've had so many platforms that we have had and produced for making our government accountable to the citizens of the Bronx in terms of creating better air quality for us. We have definitely worked together for the last 9 years on a project called HEARTS. The HEARTS Center is the former Lincoln Recovery Center, where the Young Lords were actually giving care to many of the community members to get them off of, get them off from their addiction to drugs via the Dr. Mutulu Shakur method of acupuncture and Reiki and some of the other means by which the young lords use to advocate for this community and rehabilitation from drug use. But we've been advocating for that center for years now because we want to turn it into what we call the heart center, to have pillars, three pillars that we feel are very necessary for the Bronx community, which is health, education, and the arts. And so our focus has been really trying to be a coalition that would advocate for our community and bring about those resources to the community and bring about health in the whole aspect of whole being and wellness for the South Bronx and the Bronx proper.
Wow, that is phenomenal to hear. The Young Lords are near and dear to my heart because I spent, upwards of 20 years researching the organization, and I just finished publishing a book on the Young Lords, a history of the organization titled The Young Lords, A Radical History. Mm-hmm. And one of my chapters is about the Lincoln Hospital occupation, about which you probably know, which is that the Young Lords occupied Lincoln Hospital to expose and dramatize the horrific conditions of health under which Black and brown people were being served or not served. Right. And the program that you refer to was started in September of 1970 when another occupation happened, which included the Young Lords, Black Panthers, but also other people in the community who wanted to address the issue of drug addiction or substance abuse. Essentially, the Bronx was the place with the highest percentage of people who were suffering with this substance abuse to heroin. And that program, as you probably know, was the first to use acupuncture in the treatment of substance abuse, which is now practiced across the country and across the world. And Mutulu Shakur was certainly a part of that, as was Mickey Melendez, one of its first directors, who was also one of the founders of the Young Lords. So this is really touching to hear that you are continuing that tradition of community health in the Bronx. Wow. So let me ask you a question. We're here in New York City amidst this COVID-19 pandemic, living in a system organized around private medicine, not communal health.
Right.
Can you speak on the fallout of that reality as you see it from your gut? Because you seem to be at ground zero. The Bronx has, I think, the highest rate of infection in New York City. And so what are you seeing vis-a-vis COVID-19 within the framework of a capitalist-driven system organized around private medicine and not communal health?
Well, I have to be honest enough and say that I'm outraged because I'm seeing complete neglect. And it really frustrates me that 30 years later, after what you've researched in terms of the Young Lords having to actually occupy Lincoln Hospital, that we're probably at a place in our stance where we're probably going to have to do that again, because our community has to really be ready to be up in arms and mobilize itself to do the work that the government has decided not to do. The hospital's completely overcrowded with the lack of resources and medications and gloves and masks to even support their medical staff. We have people waiting for days just to be seen, if they are seen. We have the reality of you know, turning on the TV or the radio each day to hear our mayor and our governor go back and forth as if it's a pissing contest when people are dying, about what needs to be done and what should be done and who has the authority to do what. But my question to both of them, right, is where are the portable hospitals for the South Bronx, which is being heavily hit by this crisis? Right? You can spend 2 days to put up, you know, a portable hospital in Jacob Javits Center. You can put up one in Central Park. But when it comes to the Bronx, you decide that you will take 3 weeks or that it will take 3 weeks to put a portable hospital up. And then you're going to put it in the Northwest Bronx all the way in Van Cortlandt Park, where the people who are suffering are so far away and can barely get to it. So I want to, you know, I mean, I don't know what your readers think about that, but I'm like, how does that make sense? We have areas right here that can be set up for portable hospitals. We have sites that can be set up to be testing centers right here, and none of that has been done. And people who are seeking testing are being turned away because if they don't have insurance, they're being told you have to pay for this, or your insurance is getting billed for this, so that if you don't have insurance, we can't even give you this test. So that's the reality that we are seeing here in the South Bronx, which is something that should enrage anybody, because at this point, if you have an area that's being heavy hit, why would you ignore it? And it's kind of like their nice little way of saying we don't give a damn and we've never give a damn. And so any community member who knows better should definitely be ready to be up in arms and say, what's going on? And why are you subjecting us to this level of treatment? Because they openly say, you know, we're not surprised. It shouldn't be a surprise that the Bronx is getting heavy hit, because we continue, you know, to give them the pre-existing conditions that allow for them to be heavy hit, right? We also have a government who's decided to keep us home, and many of the concentrated NYCHA buildings that we have here are not even, the conditions are so deplorable. So you're confining people to spaces that have mold, that have asbestos, that have lead, that have so many conditions that are not conducive for them to be even living in, that are creating the pre-existing conditions, and then you're putting them on top of each other because it's a whole concentration of people, and then you have no resources for them to access for help if there is a crisis. So, you know, I mean, common sense for me and my, you know, my family always said common sense ain't common, right? But we continually see through the play out of history how neighborhoods and communities like ours are completely neglected all the time when it comes to getting resources and it comes to getting the things necessary to alleviate and mitigate disaster situations. So what we normally see and what we normally do is coalitions like mine, we begin to, you know, mobilize amongst ourselves and kind of, you know, get the resources and get the information that we need to get. And we get them to the families that are in such need and dire need at this point, and try to figure out how amongst ourselves we get resources so that we protect each other and love on each other when the outside external forces like our government should be helping us is not.
I agree with you that common sense is not too common. And what is common is the profit motive and cronyism. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you heard that the company that got the contract to build that field hospital at Van Cortlandt Park is a defense company that reportedly bungled an enormous Iraq War contract for healthcare centers back during the Iraq War. The name of that contractor is Parsons Corporation, and it got the contract to build that hospital that you referenced on April 3rd. But let me give you a sense and remind my listening audience of what we know about this contractor, Parsons Corporation. 16 years ago, Parsons received $240 million to build 150 healthcare centers in Iraq. But according to an oversight agency, 2 years into the deal, Parsons had spent roughly 77% of the funds that it got, with little progress made and only six health centers completed out of the 150. 131 centers were partially constructed, eight had been canceled, and 121 were later, quote, terminated for convenience. And this is according to a 2006 report that was conducted by the Inspector General for Iraq Construction. So this is huge. The folks who've been hired to build a 200-bed facility outdoors in the Bronx at Van Cortlandt in Carajo Land, essentially, is an agency that is bankrupt, that stole the money pretty much in Iraq and laughed all the way to the bank. So this is what we're being given in the Bronx. And I mean, this is the kind of atrocity that we should be up in arms about and occupying buildings over, as did the young lords. We're going to have to end this interview shortly, but I have two questions. First, can you give us a sense of and the name of the organization for which you work at the moment, and mm-hmm. how people could help, volunteer, donate money, apply for a job if you have openings available, mm-hmm. whatever, donate food. Mm-hmm. And I know it's an organization, but it's also working with a broader coalition. So can you give us the 411 on that?
So South Bronx Unite is an organization. You can go to our website, southbronxunite.org, and you can donate to our webpage to many of the programs that we have available. And they can get the money to, there's another organization, Mount Haven Mamas, that actually has been buying food and getting resources for many of our families. So we haven't up until this point worked in terms of hiring people, but we're looking. If you know of anybody who has website skills, if you know of anybody who can, who is a community organizer, we're looking to hire one as soon as possible. So they can go on our website and begin to contact us for that. In addition to South Bronx Unite, I do a lot of work with IFCO Pastors for Peace, and they're right now in the process of rolling out a huge campaign for Cuba's interferon alpha 2B drug to get to the States. And we're looking for many hospitals who have research capacities who would be willing to collaborate with Cuba on research to step up to the plate so that we can actually get some of that medicine here to mitigate some of the atrocities that are happening with people and the deaths that are going on. So any way you can reach out to IFCO at www.ifconews.org if you want to be a part of that campaign, or you can reach out to southbronxunite.org.
So can you tell us about the interferon alpha 2B drug that is so important? What is it, and what is it used for, and is it banned here in the United States? A lot of people want to know.
So the alpha-2-ferron drug is actually a drug. It's a recombinant antiviral drug. And what interferon is something that actually is a protein that actually is in our bodies, our own immune systems. And what happens with this particular drug, it actually interferes with the messenger RNA of a virus, a bacteria, or a tumor cell. And once it interferes with that messenger RNA, it actually prohibits it from proliferating and beginning to continue to grow in a human cell. So right now, what we're starting to see in significant amounts is that the interferon is being used as one of the main medical treatments throughout the world. And this drug is actually helping patients who are, you know, nearing that that state of seriousness or graveness to actually stop it in its path, stop the virus from replicating. And cutting it off from getting that patient from where it is to a more severe state. And so we're really looking to, and also in addition to that, once it stops the virus from proliferating, it actually also builds up the body's immune system to actually fight against that virus. And so the interferon alpha-2b is something that Cuba has been using for a long time. It was used in an Ebola crisis. It was used in several other crises that have taken place. And so they're very capable of using this drug, knowing what it's used for, and is also looking for a level of collaboration, because everybody worldwide is looking for a cure or a drug that will consistently help to stop the many bodies that are dying from this COVID-19. So we're looking, like I said, to really roll out a campaign for that to be brought here. And I'm told that in the U.S. we do have a capacity for interferon drug, but it's administered in a different way. And the interferon alpha-2b drug is actually administered, the Cuba drug is actually administered through respiratory means, or like a nasal mask. So it allows it to go straight to the respiratory system and is an easier way to actually introduce the medicine to patients. And so we're looking to actually roll out this campaign so that we can actually get that interferon alpha-2b drug here in the United States, so that we can actually stop the many deaths that are occurring here.
Thank you. Okay, we want to close out this interview with a question about your experience in Cuba. Can you give us a sense of the texture and feeling and training that you were lucky to have in Cuba? And just so folks know, I'm speaking to Dr. Barber, who works in the area of public health in the Bronx, and she was trained in Cuba's ELAM program, the Latin American School of Medicine, on the island, which is now world famous. And I'm Johanna Fernandez, the host of It's a Good Day on WBAI 99.5 FM on the dial, streaming globally at WBAI.org. Dr. Barber.
So I think my experience in Cuba was actually one of the best experiences that I've ever had in my life. In terms of just the medical training, I would say it was absolutely stellar. From the very beginning, you get a different level of hands-on training. It's very interesting and very wonderful to approach medicine from the knowledge or the thought that it is a right for everybody to have it. And I think when you approach medicine as a right, and you also approach it in the way of prevention, you understand that the best way in which to, I'm thinking in Spanish, the best way to actually stop a disease course or pathology in its course is to actually always prevent. And that's the cheapest course. And so one of the things that Cuba does, anybody who's ever been familiar with the Cuban system or who has been in the Cuban system, know that they have a doctor nurse team for every 10 block radius, right? So a doctor and a nurse live in the community that they serve. They know all of the members in that community. They know what's going on in that community. They don't, Cuba as a national system never ever divorces medicine from public health. They're intertwined. They're never separated. And so you have to have, you know, the public health aspect where you have the people in the community knowing the pulse of the community that can do an assessment of the health of that community. And then you follow up with the medicine and you, you know, treat them and care for them, whether it's allopathic medicine, whether it's naturopathic medicine, but you have those two components working hand in hand with each other at all times. And so it was amazing to me to know that a doctor nurse team, you know, in the morning was working in the clinic, but in the community, right? And then in the afternoons, once they finished their clinic hours, they were actually going knocking on door to door to actually see the patients. If there was a new baby in the community that was born, you go, you make sure that that mom was okay, that baby was okay. You make sure that the environment in which that baby and that mom lived in was very conducive for that baby to be well, right? When does that happen here? Right. In the United States, you have, you know, whatever the case may be, if you have an outbreak of whatever disease going on, right, you have a pulse on it because you have that doctor nurse team and sometimes even medical students knocking on the doors. Like, for example, now in the COVID crisis, you have third, fourth and fifth year medical students that are going around and doing what we call pesquisaje, and they're knocking on everybody's door. Do you have fever? Do you have shortness of breath? Do you have this? Do you have that? And so every single day we're isolating people that may or may not have, you know, this virus, and we're taking them out of community. We're screening them. We're making sure that they're okay and that, you know, everybody in their influence is okay. And so that level of screening where you do prevention first, is model, is stellar, you know, because you're actually preventing all of, you know, these people from getting sick. And even, you know, if they are not at that primary care level where the doctor nurse team can handle it, you have the second tier, which is the polyclinic. And then you have the third tier, which is actually the hospital if they have to be admitted. And so you see firsthand how with little resources, this nation, you know, turns heads in terms of how creative they've had to be because of the blockade, which has cut them off for so many years. They have had to be very resourceful among themselves. And so the love that I have for Cuba is a love that I have for my community, because it's very similar. Like, we see the lack of resources. We see the minimal access to things. So we've had to be so creative in who we are and creating the necessary resources and the tools that we needed to survive. And Cuba has done that for such a long time that they've become experts at it. And, you know, that little island that, you know, because it has such little resources and has, you know, undergone and have been stomped on by this U.S. blockade for so long, should have never survived. But because they're such a unified nation, because they are so health literate, because the whole education, the whole, you know, government gives their citizens access to free education, and there's like 99.9% level of literacy within that island, like, they are unified beyond you would ever imagine. And they've been able to accomplish so much in their revolution, and that the world gets to see that every day. And so I'm just elated at the fact that I was able to study under that level of tutelage. They've taught me everything I know. They taught me what I needed to know to do missions in Haiti, to do missions anywhere, to do missions in the South Bronx. They've taught me the level of courage to advocate for a people and a community. They've taught me what it is to understand what it is to be my brother and my sister's keeper, and that nobody gets left behind. And so as we see today, even as they become a nation that does internationalism and sends doctors all over the world when there's a need. So that has been very much something that's been ingrained in me by who they are. And I was only taught by the best of their nation. And so I honor that. And I just thank them for everything that they've given me. And I'm sure that my community, when they receive of me, my community thanks them as well, because they've equipped me.
In my own research, Dr. Barber, I've written that the term diseases of poverty was coined during the Cuban Revolution in its mission to eliminate disease that is essentially man-made. So the crises of nutrition, which produce disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, all of these diseases, that the diseases that destroy our bodies, can be eliminated if we address the root causes of poverty.
Yes.
And in many ways, the Young Lords, but also the Black Panthers and other 60s radicals, attempted to do here in the United States in communities like the South Bronx, East Harlem, and Harlem. They attempted to launch these door-to-door community health projects that teamed up with social workers, medical technicians, and doctors to address in a holistic way the problem of public health in our communities. And it is really inspiring to hear you talk about that and talk about your training. And I'll just say that, you know, one of the young lords who was working at Lincoln Hospital during the time said that the issue of health is essential to society and to our very existence, because it's the moment when we feel most vulnerable and most mortal. And it is an area of existence that we must, if we are a humane society, uphold and uplift. And we need to empower people like you who are doing this work on the ground. And the Bronx is really privileged to have you. I've just discovered that Dr. Barber is, in fact, about to publish a new book. Dr. Barber, you've hidden this from our listening audience. I don't understand why. Can you tell us very quickly about your book?
So my book is called The 30 Days of Thanks, and it centers around my life experiences and just what I'm about. And so what I did is each day, each of the 30 days has a theme, right? And that specific theme is what I'm giving thanks for or gratitude for. And as I talk about that theme, I relate that theme to a story in my life or an experience in my life. And so, for example, if I talk about shelter, I talk about the one time my daughter and I lived in the homeless shelter system of New York City. And as I relate that whole experience and what we went through and what that was about in my life and what I gained from that, afterwards, I talk about a nonprofit organization or a particular person that is doing the work of providing shelter or whatever resource that gratitude is giving thanks for. And so we point to just organizations that are doing the wonderful and great work throughout the U.S. and the world that people can actually donate to and support and give their volunteerism to so that we can make this world a better place.
Wow. And so tell us the title of the book again, and how can folks purchase it?
The title of the book is 30 Days of Thanks, A Journey of Healing and Deliverance, and is actually going to be published in the next few weeks. So I just, like, I'm finishing the book cover, and then once we finish the book cover, it'll be out on Amazon and several other distributors.
And who's the publisher?
The publisher is Habakkuk Publishing.
Wonderful. And if folks want to reach you, once again, where can they email or find the organization you work with?
They can email me at ifconews.org. Or they can email me at hijadejah2003@yahoo.com.
Thank you so very much. And if you didn't get any of that information, you can email me at johanna@wbai.org, and I will make sure to put you in touch with Dr. Barber. Dr. Barber, thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And that's the end of our show for today. You've been listening to non-corporate, listener-funded Peace and Justice Radio, WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York. This show is produced by Jorgen Ostensen, Ajamu Sankofa, and Shandani Smith. I'm your host, Johanna Fernandez. Thanks for tuning in.
$10 a month. It's the price of a gigabyte of data for that iPad you never use. It's two overpriced coffees you ordered when you forgot to look at the menu. It's your overzealous attempts to meet the credit card minimum at the bodega on the corner. But $10 a month could be a lot more. Become a BAI buddy and commit to a recurring monthly donation to WBAI. This money will help us continue to broadcast the thoughts and perspectives of the progressive public. A BAI buddy is also not without perks. Your monthly contribution will earn you a WBAI tote bag and a member card offering Zipcar sales, discounted meals at select restaurants, and a handful of other benefits. You will also become a full voting member of WBAI, and our diverse programming will reflect your voice. Go to givetowbai.org and become a BAI buddy to support Free Speech Radio today.
Yo, this is G-Love on WBAI, New York.